more evidence is emerging about what officials knew about Nidal Malik Hassan before the shooting at Fort Hood and what they did not know. It seems U.S. intelligence officials knew that the suspected Fort Hood shooter was exchanging emails with a very radicalized cleric in Yemen.
I mean, this is a whole, what did they know, when did they know it, could it have possibly prevented the tragedy at Fort Hood last week? I mean,
and perhaps, why were they not talking to one another? Because the other thing that is being reported by our friend Scott Shane at the New York Times is that his colleagues, Hassan's colleagues at Walter Reed, knew that he was becoming increasingly unstable. So 8 years after 9/11, supposedly taught our law enforcement agencies that they need to share information. Why didn't these two groups communicate this information with each other? Scott Shane, National Security Reporter for our partner, the New York Times. Can you answer that? Have we not learned? Is this a question of the fact that this was nobody on either end was alarmed enough to call attention to put up the red flags? Or is this that we haven't learned the lessons of 9/11 and they're not communicating with one another?
Well, some of the folks that I talked to yesterday pointed out that, in fact, the system worked up to a point. They intercepted these emails so that they actually got hold of these emails. And instead of dumping them in a database somewhere, they actually did pass them on to a terrorism task force. They assigned someone to assess them. That person, again, didn't set it aside. He pulled Hassan's personnel file, records of his work at Walter Reed. But apparently one of the issues, and we don't know the contents of the emails exactly, but we've been told that they were largely questions, not comments, not expressions of extreme views, not certainly no hints that he had any violent acts in mind, but questions about Islamic interpretation. And that the cleric, whose name is Anwar al-Awlaki, wrote back a couple times, but in a very non-committal way, nothing inflammatory, not encouraging Hassan to take any act. So the judgment was made at the time, and I guess eventually when we see the emails and so on, we'll be able to make our own judgments, that it wasn't alarming. He also discovered that this seemed to be in line with research that Hassan was conducting. So there seemed to be an innocent explanation for those communications.
Okay, and very quickly, the questions among his colleagues at Walter Reed Medical Center was whether or not he was psychotic and fit for duty?
Well, I think there's actually quite a range of views among those colleagues. Some thought he was okay. Some were alarmed at his increasingly outspoken views against the war and against the participation of American Muslims in the war. But their concerns were never passed on to the guy who was examining the emails, and they never learned of the existence of the emails.
Right.
So it's true that those two halves of the puzzle were never put together.
Okay. Scott Shane, thanks. He's the New York Times national security correspondent. So at this point, the legal process begins. And to explain how this legal process works, what happens with Major Nidal Hassan now, we have Eugene Fidel. He teaches military law at Yale Law School. He's also president of the National Institute of Military Justice and joins us from Connecticut. Good morning, Eugene.
Hi, Celeste.
So take us through this process. Once the major gets out of the hospital, where does he go?
Into confinement. I have no question but that he'll be put in pretrial confinement, which is provided for under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or UCMJ. And just as a sort of first step in thinking about this, which jurisdiction would handle these charges?
You mean civilian or military?
Civilian or military, and state versus federal civilian. Personally, I think the center of gravity of this case is in the military setting. I don't have any doubt about that, and I think that it will be ultimately handled one way or another by the military justice system.
So, Eugene Fidel, I read a commentary from someone saying, look, this was a military officer who took a violent act against other military personnel on a military base. There's no question this will be a military trial. Is that accurate?
That's what I think.
Okay, so does the defendant have any say in where he gets tried?
No.
None at all?
None at all. I mean, his lawyers could try to make an argument that the case should be tried in the civilian federal courts.
But that holds no water.
I don't see any purpose in their doing that. I think it would be a wash as a practical matter. And the person can be tried by both the state and the military. There's no double jeopardy problem there. There's a slight legal issue as to whether the state would have jurisdiction here, depending on how the government happens to hold the piece of property on which...
Whether it's federal land.
Whether it's exclusive federal land.
The other question I had is that his lawyer appears to already be establishing as much as he can that Major Hassan is going to have a very tough time getting a fair trial. Is this his argument to try and move the venue of this trial?
Personally, I think there will be a change of venue. I just it's a very unusual set of facts. A lot of people have been killed and injured here. I'm not, making a judgment about ultimate legal guilt, incidentally. People will form their own conclusions. But I think that it would be very wise of the military to simply move the venue. Yeah.
Now, what is the procedure if it were to go to civilian trial? I mean, under what circumstances? I know it's probably not going to happen, but this jurisdictional question is kind of interesting. I mean, if, for example, one or more of the people killed were civilians, would there be any option to go to a civilian court in addition? And does the military have the ability to explicitly waive jurisdiction and put it into federal court on their own?
Yes. There's actually an agreement between the Department of Justice and the Defense Department. It goes back many years about how these things get resolved. And, there can be a conversation about it if you have a case that's sort of iffy as to which jurisdiction it should go to. The fact that there are civilians in the picture is sort of an atmospheric thing. It doesn't have particular legal significance. However, it is a federal crime to murder a member of the armed forces or other federal official when they're acting in the line of duty. So that would be a potential hook for taking the case into federal court. But again, I don't think that's going to happen.
So, Eugene, I have read several places that there seems to be no question that the death penalty is at least going to be considered here. How common is it for an officer of the rank of major to be in this kind of case facing the death penalty, possibly facing the death penalty?
I've never heard of it happening.
Wow.
Ever.
Correct.
Okay, Eugene Fidel teaches military law at the Yale Law School. He's also president of the National Institute of Military Justice.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.